This session is a continuation of the interview for the Veterans History Project with Ralph Wagner Woolard, and I'm going to spell Woolard, W-O-O-L-A-R-D, a highly decorated veteran of the European Theater of World War II, who was with the U.S. Army's 36th Infantry Division, serving from April 1943 to October 6, 1945. The first interview took place on July 19th, the second on July 30th. Today is August 7, 2007, and we are in the WILL television studio in Campbell Hall at the University of Illinois in Urbana, Illinois. My name is Harriet Williamson. I'm a producer with WILL Radio. Also in the studio is Mr. Woolard's wife, Wilma Lee Broughton Woolard, and Julius Bolton, who is director of lighting, sound, and camera. Mr. Woolard, in the last session, you had described your recovery from wounds at a battle north of Rome in the spring of 1944, rejoining your squad as they entered the south of France and proceeded into the French wine country. The Battle of Celestat, followed by another battle, Ribeauvillé, where you were again wounded on December 17, 1944. And when the tape ended in the last session, you were approaching the Siegfried Line, and you were describing the German fortifications of that line. And I was wondering, is there anything that you recall that you would like to add from our last session?
Well, thank you. Yes, there's one incident that I would like to address. As you know, part of our work is locating enemy artillery units. And we were in an area known as the Ardennes, which is a heavily forested area in southeast Belgium and where it touches Germany. And we were held up there. And part of the holdup was the Germans had a lot of artillery at that particular place. And the intelligence officer directed our squad to go to a house that was located all to itself. There were no other houses around. It was a house with an attached barn where they kept cattle in the barn, just a wall between the barn and the house, typical of that area. And this place stood out like a sore thumb in a clearing. And we knew pretty well that if we were to go there, we would get artillery fire. And if it was not directed at us, it would be directed to some of the other units some distance away from us. So, in the cover of darkness before dawn, my squad went to this house. And we were afforded three riflemen from an infantry company as extra protection. And we quickly got into the house. We decided how we were going to carry out the observation. It was a two-story house. Three of us went upstairs to look out windows, and the remainder of the men on the lower floor. We would periodically change positions because as you, in observing, you get tired after a while. You lose your concentration. So I was upstairs with two men, and we were pretty certain that at daylight the Germans would know we were there. And that was, we were to, if at all possible, take what we call an azimuth on the direction of the German fire. Now, this is usually done at night, but you can do a bit of it during the daylight hours. So, without going into too much detail on that, shortly after daybreak, we knew that we had been discovered there, and we heard incoming shell. And the three of us who were upstairs rolled ourselves into a tight ball and tried to protect yourself. Fortunately, it hit the roof, and that is the first round did. And succeeding rounds mostly hit the roof. And also hit a small tree, which was outside the house, of course. Now, prior to this artillery coming in, one of the three fellows who had been afforded to us by a rifle company was a BAR man. He was Browning automatic rifle. And in trying to position ourselves if we were ever attacked by infantry, he suggested that he occupy a small shed which was some 30 or 40 feet from the house. And from that shed, he had a good, what we call, field of fire, about 180-degree movement of his weapon. And he could cover about 180 degrees of a circle. And so he was there. We kept getting this artillery fire. We observed it as best we could, but soon drove us downstairs to the first floor. And suddenly the artillery stopped, and we saw movement. The house was located in a clearing. Beyond the clearing were trees, heavily forested area, and we saw a movement and among those trees. We knew that we would be attacked by infantry. I must say that at this time in the war, the Germans had lost a lot of their good officers and their good non-commissioned officers. And it was not a prudent move on the part of the officer or non-commissioned officer who was in charge of the Germans. If he was going to attack us, it would have been far better for him to wait till nightfall and then come across, try to get behind us. These German soldiers, they were directed to get across the clearing. And this clearing also had a trail or a little road running into it and out of it. And the first Germans that we saw tried to cross one of those trails or roads. And fortunately, we had enough firepower to prevent any of them from getting across. And certainly the BAR man, who was adding his bit to the whole thing. And then they tried. And again, this BAR man took charge of things. And he prevented any Germans from crossing that road. But there were several of them over there, and one of the things that I did was to call for mortar fire from some of the mortar people who were some distance away from us. But they had not an air map, but a typical map showing topographical features, and they knew where we were, and they and a few minutes after I called for fire, my first round landed. It was too far. It was too distant to do any good. I told them that they'd have to bring it in 50 or 60 feet or so, which they did, and we knew by the sound of wounded Germans that the mortars were doing their work. And that pretty well took the starch out of the German attack. We were delighted, of course, and all of us knew that this BAR man had done his bit. So in a few moments, I called over to him, and no one answered. So I decided to go over, went over and found that he had a hold of his weapon and his finger still in the trigger guard of the weapon, but he was dead. And I remember that I just couldn't quite comprehend the thing. He was a young man, probably three or four years older than my years, but he had afforded us protection that was just outstanding. I picked him up. His body was still warm. Carried him over to the barn section and called the other men in. And I guess we just all stood around the fellow. And one of those moments when the most profound thing you can do is to just remain quiet. So I never knew his name. But I told the two fellows from his rifle company that when they got back to their company, they had to tell a story of this fellow. I would probably never get in touch with their company again, but they should let their commanding officer know what he did and put him in for a decoration. Now, in a few moments, a telephone line had been laid to this house at the time we went into the house in the morning. So I received a telephone call that we were to go back to our own company, where the company was going to move out to some other position. And so I never got beyond that. Had to leave the two riflemen there with him. We asked for a stretcher to be brought over and to get him out. But it was one of those instances when a fellow, evidently a small, what had happened, a shell had hit a tree over the shed, and there had been a small piece of shrapnel enter his back. He was on his belly, stomach, firing the weapon, and this piece entered his back, and it must have just hit an artery, and he just slowly bled to death. But during the time he was alive, he continued to shoot the weapon. So it was one of those things that you never forget, seeing that you don't want to forget, really. Well, that was in mid-November, and there was a lot of war left. I'll skip forward now to the Siegfried Line, which takes us up into March. About March 19th, about March 20th, the Siegfried Line was a series of fortifications that destined to just keep anyone from getting into Germany. And huge pieces of concrete, row after row, so that the tanks absolutely couldn't get over. They consisted of a series of pill boxes. These pill boxes were concrete fortifications built into the side of hills. And they had concrete walls about 3 feet thick with little gun apertures in which they could stick a machine gun and shoot out. The only way to get to those was we had a group of engineers with us who were acquainted with explosives, and they used what was called a beehive. The beehive is shaped like a funnel, and it's closed on the large end, and the only opening into it is a very small piece that sticks out. And you have to get up to the pillbox some way and fasten that on the pillbox so that the small end of the funnel is directed into the concrete. And in order to do that, you have some sticky stuff that that you can put on the legs of this thing. You push it against the pillbox and it holds in place, and then the engineers get back. Before getting back, they start a fuse burning, and the thing then eventually explodes. But it will knock a hole through three feet of concrete and kill anybody inside. Mm. The concussion will kill anyone. So that was accomplished in our area by a group of engineers who worked with the infantry. The way they got up to the concrete pillbox was if the infantry would keep a steady rain of fire into the aperture and then allow the engineers to crawl up, which they did. And eventually we got through that. I recall a very chilling scene on the 19th, just the day we penetrated, or the day before we penetrated the line and blew it up. We had taken a prisoner. I'd forgotten the circumstances of how we took this prisoner, but he had been horribly wounded. And we had no way of getting him back at the time to a aid station, and he begged all night to be shot. You can't forget those things, so they just continue to ring in your ears at times. But he wanted, his face was so would be so disfigured, and he was blinded, nose shut off. He was terrible shape, but he asked to be killed. No one would do it. I can think of only one other instance like that on the casino line, when a German that was wounded was in a foxhole that was half full of water, and he kept asking to be, he was terribly wounded, asking to be killed. And I think finally some GI must have come along and just mercifully put his head under the water and drowned him, mm-hmm. because it was going on all night. Well, we got through the Siegfried line by the March 20th, and by March 23rd, I recall that there was a tank battalion that got to the Rhine River, and it was a kind of a high water mark. But from then on, we were fighting in small villages, the Germans were putting up a lot of resistance, but they just didn't have the capacity anymore to really slow us down for very long. And then, after crossing the Rhine, and we ran into a slave labor camp. This was not a concentration camp in a conventional sense, but a slave labor. There were Russians and Estonians and Latvians and Jewish people who were put to work in a nearby factory, and they were given very meager rations, not enough to keep you alive. You worked until you died, and then they brought in other slave laborers to fill the place. But the Germans were retreating at this point. They wanted to hide this slave labor camp, but it was impossible because we got there before they could do the job. And there were about 100 bodies in a big pit that had been recently dug. And then the Germans had poured diesel fuel or gasoline over these bodies and set them afire. There were still slave laborers in the camp. They were just in rags and tatters. They were malnourished, they were skin and bones. So there were certain things that some people these days don't seem to want to believe. But believe me, there were terrible conditions. Terrible. We did have one large city we took called Kaiserslautern. It's probably a city of 60,000-70,000 people, and it was defended pretty well. But after pushing the Germans out, there were a few civilians around, and we began, the U.S. Army began moving through this town with tanks and trucks, all kinds of equipment. And this German fellow alongside the road said, "Why did it take you so long?" He could not fathom the amount of equipment that we had. They were just overpowering. Well, what they didn't realize was that it took us a long time because we had to cross 3,000 miles of water to get all that equipment there. And the American factories, by this time, were turning out tanks like they were Ford automobiles. You know, they're just clicking them out. So there was a reason that it took, good reason it took so long. In March, we knew pretty well that the war was over. By the first day of March. We were down in southern Germany. We were continuing to advance. We crossed the border into Austria. And on March 5th, I believe it was, we received orders not to advance anymore. Now, we knew pretty well that some of the highest ranking people politically and also militarily had retreated into Austria, deep in the mountains. And the army sent out some special units to look for them, and we began to get messages from them that they wanted to give up. So the arrangements were made for some of these people to come in and give themselves up. And among them, Hermann Göring, who was the second man to Adolf Hitler and head of the German Air Force. I'll come into him a little bit later, but on March 8th, then, I believe it was, the war was over. We were told that and the Germans were signaled that they were ready to give up. We were asked to establish points along the highways in Austria and just wait for the German soldiers to walk our way and give themselves up, which they began doing. As they came in, they came in with their weapons, and we told them where to put their guns. There were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. And we told them where to put their guns. If they had liquor, and some of them did, where to put that. Some of the German officers felt that they would have a right to keep their own weapon, their pistol particularly. They were told quickly that that would not be. Some of the officers were rather haughty and still wanted to let you know that they were a superior group. Some of them even came in as platoons, and the officer would come in, he'd have them all lined up in a platoon formation. He would stand in front and surrender his group. Well, that went on for a few days, and after a while, the number of soldiers, German soldiers, giving up just decreased, and things got very quiet. In respect to Hermann Göring and some of the others, the 143rd Infantry of our division, was elements of it were assigned to meet Hermann Göring at a certain place in Austria. That had all been worked out. And he came in with a whole retinue of, a whole series of trucks. And these trucks were loaded with art, paintings. Göring always wore gloves. And he had one little pickup truck full of nice gloves. Well, he thought he would be able to keep all this. He was, after all, second in command to Hitler. And he envisioned that he would have a house someplace and things would be all right. But they were not. He was stripped of all those things immediately. Whatever happened to them, I'm not sure. But he was then ultimately brought to trial, and he committed suicide. With our squad, it got quiet in Austria, and I found a little chalet there near our company headquarters, and that's where we put up. It's a nice place. I don't know who owned it, but we were there. And then all of a sudden I got a call that there was a disturbance in a farmhouse in the valley, and somebody had been killed. So I took some squad members and we went down, and it had been a Russian who had been forced to work on this Austrian farm, and he had been treated as a slave, beaten, and I don't know what all had happened to him. But he was seeking revenge. And he had taken an axe and killed this farmer. It's a big broad axe. And he made mincemeat of this farmer. It was a terrible scene. And our job was to take him into custody. And which we did. Took him up to the house where we were staying. Reported into battalion headquarters. And they then into regiment, and in a day or so, someone came and got him. I don't know, have any idea what happened to him, but there were little things like that that came up. And on one day, while I was still there, I decided to take a walk, and which wasn't the wisest thing to do. There were a few holdouts sniping at people, German soldiers who didn't want to give up and were hiding up in the Alps. But I went out on a hike and came across a group of youngsters, about fourth grade, I would say, with their teacher. And he was talking with them, and he asked if I would stay and talk with them. Of course, they spoke only German, but he spoke some English, and they asked me all kinds of questions about the United States. They got off onto the Empire State Building, and they were trying to decide whether it was taller than the Austrian mountains. It was just a nice little scene, and in a very peaceful atmosphere. And I thought, well, the world needs to be a little more like that. But then we were pulled out. We were pulled out to go into South Central Germany. And we were billeted in a hotel in the town of Nördlingen, Germany. Nördlingen is a town of 20,000 people, and this hotel had a kitchen, and we established our company kitchen in this hotel, and we ate off of white tablecloths for a while. But our work wasn't ended, and one of the major things that we got involved in was to locate all the SS troopers in town. A lot of the SS troopers had gotten out of their uniforms before they gave up, and didn't give up. They got back to their houses, their homes, some way or another, you know. So we would do SS raids. We'd get a company of men and surround four city blocks at just at daybreak, order all the men out, and the women also, and we'd separate the men and the women, and the men had to take their shirts off and show the underarm here, which they were tattooed with SS, which meant they were SS troopers. And then we dealt with them, sent them away to get indoctrinated in some other line of thinking. And that was one of the things that we did. But our my squad was assigned to, and we were not prepared for this sort of thing. We were assigned to try to help those people who were dislocated here in Europe. Thousands and thousands of people who had been, you know, in slave labor camps or had been moved all over the country. And they were trying to find relatives. They were trying to find a way to get back home. And we established ourselves in a bank building across from the hotel. And These people would come to us. We would try to help in our very limited capacity. We did help some of them. We were able to get some passes so they could get on some of the trains that were running. And there were a few trains that did still run after the war. And we could get some passes through the military that these folks could get on the train and go in the direction of their home or city. One interesting couple came to us. The fellow was about 40. The woman was about 30. And they were both attorneys. They had been trained as attorneys. And they had met in a slave labor camp, and they wanted to get married. And they asked if we could help them get married. They had been to some office there in the Nerdingen that refused to give them a certificate to get married. Whether it was because they were Jewish or what, I don't know. But one of the interpreters in my squad was, as I told you, was his parents had been killed in a concentration camp. And we decided we were going to get something done about them. We would allow them to get married. They wanted to do the right thing. So we went to an office, and a fellow, some German behind a desk, and he said we couldn't issue them a certificate. And my interpreter, a rather formidable guy, if he really got his dander up, said, yes, there will be a certificate issued. And you get one out, and I'll read it, see if it's in order. Well, we got that done. And they also wanted a religious service. And that's customary in Europe. You have the legal, you meet the city requirements or the state's requirements, then you meet your religious requirements. One of the other interpreters in German in my squad was Jewish also, and he could lead Jewish religious services. He agreed to marry them. And so we decided we wanted to have a party for them. And so I said, well, I'll go over and see the cook, head cook. Well, I walked in the door there in the hotel. And, of course, the cooks are notorious for their ways. But he said, get out of my kitchen. That was his first words to me. And I said, now, Skinny, I have something to really tell you. I think you'll be interested. He said, I'm not interested in anything. I have 250 men that I have to cook for. Get out. I said, no. Now, here's the story. And we think we need a little cake. We're going to have a little party for them. What could you do for us? He said, do you think this is a delicatessen? I said, no, I know it's not, but these are unusual circumstances. He said, everything's unusual. So I hummed and hawed. And he said, and I suppose you want icing on the cake, too. I said, well, that'll be nice. And he said, I suppose you want a little man and woman standing on top of it. And I said, no, that wouldn't be necessary. So he says, be here at 11 o'clock tomorrow, and I'll see that you have a cake. But I never want to see you again. he was a character. But those were the things that were going on. There was an information and education program that was also going on, conducted by, I guess, cooperation between the State Department and the U.S. Army, trying to get soldiers acquainted with what was happening in other parts of the world, keeping us also abreast of what was going on in Japan or with the Far Eastern conflict. And I was asked to do the information education program. I don't know why, because there were people with far more education there than I had. But we carried that on for some weeks. We continued to round up SS troopers at every opportunity. We were issued orders by commanding general of U.S. armies that there would be no fraternization with the Germans, either women or men. And it was very strongly written. But that somehow wears thin after a while. And there was, you know, relationships that developed between soldiers and German women, and it was something that, regardless of who issued the orders, it was going to be disobeyed in some way, mm-hmm. and sometimes rather on a wholesale basis. But during that time, I was offered a chance to go to the to attend the University of Sorbonne. This was just one of those things that the Army was doing for some of the GIs, but at that time I wanted to go home. If I took it, it meant that I was not going home. I'm going to stay there in school. So my interest was in going home, and I did so, and got home on October. Well, I was got home in about October 1st. I believe my discharge reads October 5th, and discharged in Fort McCoy in Wisconsin.
Now, when you left Europe, how was it determined when you could go home?
They established a point system. A point system that had several parts to it. And you had to get so many points in order to go home.
Mm-hmm.
How many theaters you had been in. By a theater, like North Africa was a theater. Mm-hmm. War. The Italian campaign was a theater. The southern France or any part of France mm-hmm. was a French campaign. I never tried to keep track of them, but it's surprising how many the records the Army does keep. But I had five or six campaigns that mm-hmm. I was in. The number of years you had been overseas counts so much.
Mm-hmm.
The medals that you may have earned.
Mm-hmm.
I had two Purple Hearts, and those were important. That is, they carried a lot of points mm-hmm. with them. Did I say combat infantry badge?
Right,
combat infantry badge. And then Bronze Star.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things added up to, I got to go home pretty early, earlier than a lot of fellows.
Now, do you think that the Army wanted to keep you, in other words, by sending you to school at the Sorbonne, do you think that they wanted to encourage you to stay in the military? Because you had, you had had a lot of responsibility for a very young person.
Yeah.
And
I really don't know. I don't think they may have wanted to encourage a number of people, but I wasn't very interested, for one thing. And but it could well be. I've never thought of it that way. Mm-hmm. But thanks for bringing it up.
Now, when you were discharged, were you still in Europe in October?
I left Europe in, let's see, it took about 12 days to get across. It was in September, late September, that landed in the States, and then went by train to Fort McCoy, Wisconsin.
So you were on a transport ship?
Yes.
And where did the ship then enter the U.S.?
In Boston.
In Boston. Mm-hmm. And so then from Boston you went by train to Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Now, along the way or before you left, were there any military ceremonies that recognized people's service?
No.
Did that happen when you got home?
No.
No? Did it happen when you were in Wisconsin?
No.
No. So there was no formal recognition?
That's right.
No parades, no welcome home?
Absolutely none. Absolutely none.
Now, how did people feel about that?
I never heard anyone really express themselves on it. I think the people were deeply appreciative, but it had been a long war, and I think people were just happy to have their sons and daughters home. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I think I would have felt out of place in a parade.
Mm-hmm. What was it like being on a transport ship then coming home as opposed to when you went?
Oh, it was, the mood was much higher. And a lot of singing, a lot of jokes, a lot of telling of stories and what they were and their plans for schooling or for work. Mm-hmm. A lot of looking forward. Yeah. That's it was pretty lighthearted mood. There were frankly, there were some who were dreading it. Some whose wives had decided that they didn't want to wait any longer. Mm-hmm. And there were some really despondent men in regard to that. Mm-hmm. on the boat. But in general, the mood was much lighter.
So when you came home then, you were at Fort McCoy. Mm-hmm. In Wisconsin.
Camp McCoy.
McCoy. And how long did you have to remain there before you were able to come home?
We were there perhaps a week, no longer.
Mm-hmm. And was there any kind of program then that was offered to help people return to civilian life?
No, there was not. It was a quick processing. You were physically examined and determined whether or not you were going to get some pension because of wounds. if you had needed dental work, which I did, I needed dental work, but I didn't want to stay around and get it there. I'd had my two front teeth knocked out in a shell burst, and I had knocked my head down on my rifle barrel, and I should have had those replaced, but I waited till I got home to get a civilian to do it. But it was processed. Everybody was processed very quickly. Everybody wanted to get home, and I think there were a lot of mistakes made.
For example,
young men who should have received a pension of some sort, mm-hmm. or a larger pension than they did, and some men who didn't get anything who should have. You know, mm-hmm. Some men, in all truth, there were some men who were psychologically harmed by the war, mm-hmm. you know, and many of them were looked over. How you, mm-hmm. Something you'll grow out of, mm-hmm. Something, it'll be all right. So they pass them on through.
Do you think it was a lack of understanding, or was it a callousness on the part of the military?
I think it was both. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was both that. There's a lot of attention now being given to that, and mm-hmm. some veterans who are coming in. And I receive a 10% disability, but you know. That when that started out, I got $10 a month. That was the disability pay at the time I was discharged. And I've led a life in which I haven't been hindered by the wounds. Mm-hmm. They bother me at times, but I have led a productive life, and it never bothered me that it was just 10%. Mm-hmm. I could have probably gotten along without it, all right.
You were wounded twice. How do you gather the courage to go back? I mean, how do you psychologically then? You're in a recuperation hospital, and they tell you, okay, it's time to go back. How do you mentally gear up to do that?
Well, I could put it this way. It ain't easy. But, you look at it partly this way, that you're serving with a group of fellows in your squad that you have every respect for. And you think, you know, we need to get back together. It's important that we get the war over. Important that we keep doing our share. And you get back to the unit, and you are happy to see some of the fellows. And you find out that some are gone, mm-hmm. in your absence, and won't be back. But I went I went back, and I must tell you, you know, that I have the same fears and that anybody else has. And there were many nights you were shaking in your boots, but you're kind of buttressed by the people around you. I found that GIs were, for the most part, people who looked on the brighter side. If you had a patrol that was going out, and the first sergeant says, "No, I think that this is going to be a bad patrol. I look for a couple of you not going to return, but we needed to do it." And most of the GIs look around and say, "Well, I wonder who's going to get it, and well, I bet it'll be so-and-so." They never think of it as being them. And they try not to. But I never gave a lot of thought to preparing myself mentally to go back. It was just something that you did.
Mm-hmm.
It was going to happen, you know, and mm-hmm. I was always ready to go back. But I was very happy when the war was over. And I recall a young man, I'd spoken of him earlier, sort of a very handsome devil. And he had done some very courageous things as a member of a rifle squad before he joined my squad. And toward the end of the war, he came in much after me. I was with the 36th, 6 months before he joined us. But he just couldn't hold himself together until the war was over. And I was in a foxhole with him, and he was reading the Bible and shaking like a leaf. And he got hit there in that hole. And so I helped him get back. It wasn't a bad one. But he was just no good after that.
Mm-hmm.
He came back to join us, but he was never the same. Never the same. I'm not sure I was, but...
What makes a good soldier?
Well, a lot of people have tried to answer that question. I read an interesting article once written by a rather high officer who had been through a lot of soldiering. And he said the best soldiers that I have encountered, and I think that others have encountered, are men from the South. The Southerners have had more of a tradition of soldiering than people in the north part of the country. And he said it just kind of seems to run in their blood. But he went on to say that if we're just talking pure infantry, just the riflemen, he said, I want fellows who are just willing to take orders and carry them out. They accept what you say and they go do it. Mm-hmm. I don't want guys who are sitting around trying to analyze every move that is going to take place. I want fellows who will get up and act. Mm. And that was his view of it. The fellows that I had in my unit, well, very good soldiers. Their duties were a little bit different, and they did a lot of beefing about what they were going to have to do, but they always, in the end, did it. After the war, they were the world's worst soldiers, but when it came down to the war itself, they were good. I don't know how to answer that question. I look around today and I see a lot of young men who, if we suddenly need many more soldiers than we now have, and that's always a possibility, are going to have one heck of a hard time getting in shape physically. And I think with physically, they're so terribly overweight. It also affects their emotions. I can't help it. Mm-hmm. And I find that it's really disturbing to me to see that. I'm a lightweight myself, but at that time I was in fairly good shape. I don't know other than that how to answer you, other than when I was in the doing basic training, there were an awful lot of Southern boys in the group. And frankly, I just had to admire them. They're a pretty good group of soldiers. And I think that this general who wrote this article had something when he said that there is a tradition in the South regarding soldiering. Hmm. And I wish I could be more analytical and answer that question, but I really can't.
When you left Camp McCoy, did you go home to...
Yes, I went straight home.
Okay.
To Alton, Illinois, where my father was still working in the glassworks. My mother was a supervisor of women employees in a large mental institution.
And what happened when you got home? Was it easy to adjust to life outside of the military, or were there issues?
I think I had a little problem adjusting. I was kind of footloose and wasn't really sure how to, and I knew that I wanted to become a teacher, but I didn't know just how I was going to go about that, and I fretted and worried about it quite a bit. Where would I go to school? Would it be better to stay home and go? Was I really, I kept asking myself, am I really cut out to be a teacher? And do I have those intellectual qualities that I think fit that profession. I struggled with that for a while. And finally decided whether or not I was going to go ahead and do it. And I think my folks, my parents worried about it a bit. And but they were pretty gentle people and let me figure it out pretty much. And I determined that I would go to a college right in Alton, a denominational college, and start the training there.
What was that school?
It was Shirtliff College, a school that no longer exists. Mm-hmm. It was a Baptist operation. It's been, the campus is now a part of Southern Illinois University mm-hmm. Dental School. And it's there today. And not about 69 years ago, my wife and I were married, and this campus had a great deal to do with that marriage. And I went on to go to Washington University in St. Louis for a master's degree in educational administration and a master's degree in history.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were studying history, was war or World War II, was that of interest to you in your studies?
Yes, it was. The insights, studying other wars and other parts of the world. I had some outstanding professors at Washington University, and they would relate it to the current situation. I found that my own war experiences helped me understand some of the things that had gone on in the world, mm-hmm. and I would go ahead with your questions.
When you were in Europe, did you keep any diaries or journals?
No, I didn't. Mm-hmm. It was not a...
Were you constantly in combat when you were in Europe, for the most part, the majority of the time you were there until March?
Uh-huh.
Were you continually on the front line and in combat?
Anytime I was out of the hospital,
mm-hmm.
I was on the front line, with this exception. I got to go to a rest camp at Caserta, Italy. Got there for 3 days. It was the King's Palace of Italy in Caserta, which is north of Naples. And we didn't get to sleep in the palace, but we got to sleep in the King's stables. And there was a difference. But I was there. And then I had a few days in Nice, France.
Now, were you kind of typical of the U.S. soldier of in Europe being so much in the front line, on the front line?
Most, the ratio of men, something like this. For every soldier on the front line, there are about 11 people behind the line. That's what we are great on keeping records. We have to keep supplies moving.
Mm-hmm.
That for every man that's on the front, there have to be about 11 to 13 men supporting him.
Now, is this supporting him in Europe or supporting him across the board back in the United States?
That's just totally, mm-hmm. totally.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you feel that you were well supplied as a soldier?
Yes. When you look at other armies, you have to recognize that we did a better job. And sometimes you were issued things that didn't seem to work. Or, for example, everyone was issued gas masks. First thing you threw away was your gas mask. It just was a useless piece of equipment, we felt. And the gas really wasn't a part of things in World War II. Mm-hmm. It had been in World War I. But that was an item that went by the wayside. There were little weapons, sometimes the carbine, which is a small rifle, was not nearly as effective as they'd hoped it would be. And the Germans had better comparable rifles. Mm-hmm. There were instances that some of the clothing items didn't work well. But for the most part, we had the things that really counted.
Was the carbine your weapon?
No, I preferred the M1.
Mm-hmm. And was that something you had from the beginning to the end, the same M1?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And you're supposed to keep it in good operating condition. And we had a first sergeant who he'd look at our weapon up on the front line. You know, he'd come around and want to look at it, see that it was in good working mm-hmm. order. And but it was a fine weapon. But in these days, in warfare, in the Middle East today, that's not the rifle of choice. Mm-hmm. We have other equipment that shoots bullets much faster, one way of putting it.
What are some of the items of clothing that weren't successful?
The raincoat, I felt, was never very successful. It seemed to crack, and there was a sort of an inner lining to it, and the exterior was covered with some sort of plastic or plastic material, and tend to crack open and leak, so you weren't always dry. For a long time, we were issued leggings, which was a laced-up thing here. That you, when I first went in the Army, that's what I had. And the legging was out of canvas, and you had a long lace that intertwined up here, and you pulled it tight, mm-hmm. and then that fit down over the top of your shoes. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's clumsy. And so Army soon abandoned that and gave us the combat boot, which came up to here, had two straps on it with a buckle mm-hmm. each.
When did you receive that item of clothing?
Our troops began to get issued in just below Casino, mm-hmm. just below Casino.
And were people happy with those boots?
For the most part. Mm-hmm. They weren't waterproof by any means. There's a very famous cartoon written by Bill Mauldin, the G.I.'s cartoonist, and he has a general in a jeep going down a muddy road, and alongside here are soldiers walking in mud that's this deep. And the army has a material they call debon, which is like a grease that you're supposed to put on your shoe and it'll turn the water. Well, doesn't really do it. But the general looks over to the soldier and he says, "Have you tried debon, soldier?" Of course. Mauldin could rub it in. Well, great.
Now, did you see Mauldin while you were...
Never saw Mauldin.
So it was after the war was over you saw Mauldin?
Yes. He became a cartoonist for St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Uh-huh. And the fellow, Mauldin left and went home. And the fellow chosen to take his place as a cartoonist was a high school buddy of mine named Red Schmidt. And he was a fine artist. Well, Schmidt got a chance to come home. And we started college together in Alton. Hmm. And we took an anatomy class together. And Schmidt... we had to draw muscles and bones, and the professor was always accusing Schmidt of copying the muscles, these drawings. He could draw better than the people who had written the textbooks. Mm. But it was just interesting that Mauldin and Schmidt's paths crossed.
How did you keep in touch with your family back home? Did you write letters? Did they write letters to you?
Yes, wrote letters. And I tried to write as often as I could. And, you know, long periods of time, you're in a hole or in a house where you've got some, it may be on the front, but there's nothing going on much mm-hmm. right now. And so you write a letter. And... they try to get the mail to you as well, mm-hmm. Which I thought they did a pretty good job. Mm-hmm. And occasionally your mail was censored by an officer. That's part of the game. Mm-hmm. And sometimes my folks would get a letter with something was crossed out.
So would they look at your... would your mail be in an envelope and sealed and they would open it up, or would you have to give it to an officer to read before it was sent home?
You'd send yours, depending on where you were, you'd send them to your company mail clerk. Every company had a mail clerk. And you'd send them to him. He would in turn turn them over to an officer who was back off the front someplace. And he would snip them open with a pair of scissors and take them out and read them mm-hmm. and decide whether he could let the whole thing go or some of it had to be cut out. Mm-hmm. I never had much trouble with it because I knew pretty well that what you could do and couldn't do. First time I was wounded, I had nerve injury in the armpit, and I lost the use of my hand. I couldn't write. There was a soldier in the bed next to mine, a fellow by the name of Scaramucci. I'll never forget him. He wrote my letters for me.
Now, did your parents keep your letters?
Yes, they kept. Mm-hmm. I kept a lot of them. Mm-hmm.
Did you reread them after you came home?
I read a couple, mm-hmm. but that was all.
When you came home, did you want to talk about your experiences, or did people want to talk with you about your experiences?
Some people wanted to talk about them. Most people respected your privacy. Most of the friends that my folks had knew that I had seen quite a lot of combat, and they welcomed me home, and but that was about as far as it went. They didn't probe very much. Mm-hmm. And in respect to talking about it, my best friend, all during college, in fact, from high school, was a young man who had been in the service and received a terrible back wound. And we were together down there every day, but I don't remember once we ever talking about the war. Mm-hmm. Not once. It just left us. Mm-hmm. And he became a pharmacist, and I became a teacher.
Was there any point in your life then when you talked about the war?
I told my wife some of the things mm-hmm. that went on, and occasionally I would see, occasionally made a friend or two with whom I felt very comfortable, mm-hmm. and that I knew whatever I said to them wouldn't be passed on. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't. And I did talk to a few people like that. And there were a couple of people, you know, those little articles that I wrote in New York, mm-hmm. there were a couple of people, I think just two, that I shared those with. Mm-hmm. And my boys never probed too much. I would talk about the funny things that happened, mm-hmm. you know, and there were a lot of funny things that happened. Like we were on a front line and the Germans were 60 feet down in a street. There was a keg of wine. I got the fellows in my squad emptied that keg into a dishpan. And there was a goat walking around. This was a live goat. And they had the goat drink the wine. And then this was a house that evidently had women living in it mm-hmm. at some point. And the fellows went in and got some lipstick, and they got a hat, and they got a scarf, and a skirt, and they dressed this goat up. The goat was really wobbly, this thing. We put the goat out in the street and pushed him in the direction of the German troops. We never saw him again. I bet they ate him. But, you know, you share some things like mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. And a lot of funny things happen that take too many hours to talk about.
Have any relatives of yours or friends or come to you to talk with you for advice about going to war, because we've been in several wars since World War II?
Mm-hmm. There have been a couple who have talked with me about their sons and daughters going off. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and daughters are going off to war in this particular time. And what to tell them about war, and what things they should look for, what they should know about their weaponry, learn as much about the other man's weaponry as you can, keep yourself in good physical condition at all times. So if you have to run 50 yards, you can do it with a full pack. Just simple stay alive things like that. Mm-hmm. And but then as far as the psychological side of it, make sure that you make sure that you have some basic idea of what you are fighting for. You have some information about this. Don't go in there unprepared, that you don't know what the stakes are. And if you can't understand a little bit what you're fighting for, you're not going to do well. Mm-hmm. But try very hard to keep abreast of the news, to when you have orientation, and these troops do have orientation, that you take note. Mm-hmm. And that sergeant who's up there just isn't up there because he's beautiful. He knows something that mm-hmm. you need to know. And keep it up here. And the rest of it you keep in your heart.
I wanted to ask, actually, I'm glad you brought that up. I had several questions. One was, when you were in high school, how did you learn about the war that was coming? And was your high school education abbreviated so that you could sign up a little earlier to join the military? And I also wanted to ask you about, how did you learn what the stakes were? And was that something that you took in from learning about the news, or was it also mm-hmm. something that was brought up during your training?
I'd always read a great deal. I had some fine teachers in high school, but I think I read far more than they did. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that I'm saying that because I think they just didn't have the time to read that I read, mm-hmm. that I had. And I read primarily current events, economic matters. I read a great deal about labor unions and what was going on with them. I read everything I could get my hands on of what was going on in Nazi Germany, according to the analysts. And I read portions of Mein Kampf, the Hitler Bible, so to speak, parts of it that were translated, and I read that. And my teachers seemed to recognize that I had read fairly widely. I never did very well on the subjects that they were teaching. I was free. I passed them, of course, but I just tried to keep it kind of consumed me. I really wanted to know. I read greatly about the great rivalry, or the great war that went on in Spain prior to World War II, and the struggle that was there. It was a testing ground for the communists on one hand and the Nazis on the other hand. And I've studied that, read it, followed it, read a great deal about Benito Mussolini, what his troops had done in Ethiopia, Africa. that was part of my growing up. I just I guess it helped me form my ideas of what this world is about, and some of the injustices that are going on. The rest of your question here, maybe I lost it.
I think I've lost the thread of my question too. When you then were in basic training, what did the military teach you things about the enemy, that the enemy, and I don't know if they knew you were going to Europe or the Pacific, and did any of that run counter to what you had come across in your reading?
They didn't do a great deal in regard to helping us understand all the political and economic developments that were taking place. They just tried to make you understand that here was an enemy, and you had to do your best to defeat it. They weren't real. The army wasn't real strong at that time on orientation and on education. I think they are doing a better job now, or trying to. There's a little bit of a strain, I understand, going on because we're using up troops so rapidly right at the moment. But this army that we have has been recently has been a well-trained army with more political information than any army before it. And I think that we were not nearly so well informed that way.
Now, when you were in basic, did you know you were going to Europe versus the Pacific?
No.
No.
I did not.
Mm-hmm.
And we all wondered, and at the end of those 16 weeks, they were sent us home. But, and they told us to, however, to where to report. And mine was Newport News, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And by that I knew pretty well
mm-hmm.
where it would be, of course. But no, we didn't discuss it.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you did get to Europe, did your opinions change at all about Germans when you were there and when you came home and became even more studious of history? Did your opinions change at all again?
Well, yes. Yes and no. I'm a person who finds it difficult to carry grudges, to carry hatred, I have since had several friends who are German.
Mm-hmm.
I sat down, and a German soldier who had fought against me at casino, cooked my breakfast. I didn't know whether I was going to be poisoned or not, but he cooked my breakfast. But there are certain things that I just cannot forget. And that's the treatment of about 6 million Jewish people. Not only the Jewish people, but there were other racial groups gypsies, for example, mm-hmm. in Europe, who were also murdered by the Nazis. Mm-hmm. And it has bothered me ever since that here was Germany with some of the finest schools in the world at before World War II. Some of the very best schools. And here they were indoctrinating people to do that kind of thing. And their people, you know, they had to have the cooperation of people to do it. Mm-hmm. And it has just eaten me up ever since. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I individually have found some fine German friends.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that you have traveled to Europe, I think I was told 18 times since the war.
12 times.
12 times since mm-hmm. the war ended. And have you visited any of the places where you engaged in battle?
Yes. I've been to casino. And I've been to Celestat. I've been to Kaiserslautern. Been to Ribeauvillé several times. Mm-hmm. And I've been, I think I spoke about infiltrating the German lines for about 12 miles and in order to overlook the city of Celestat, and that I had found a hotel tavern at the top of this mountain. And I went back in search of that hotel. Mm-hmm. I was about to give up, and I turned a corner, and there it was.
Oh, my goodness.
And so it's quite a thrill. But, yes, I've been back those times. I'd like to go back again, but time moves on.
What is that experience like to go back?
Beg your pardon?
What is that experience like to go back?
Oh, it's it brings back so many memories. And I think again how difficult it was to cross certain valleys and certain streams. And but then I see some of these cities like Casino. They have rebuilt, and you have to admire the human spirit that says, you know, life has to go on. Mm-hmm. And I guess I get more emotional, extremely emotional, at Casino when I visit the graves of New Zealanders and Polish folks who lost about 1,000 people. I can't help but be emotional. And then I have stopped at the graves, cemeteries of World War I soldiers. And a very moving experience. And I recall, we were just about to pull out of the cemetery, and there was a sports car pulled up with a license plate that indicated England. And a man about 35 or 40 got out. And he went over to the cemetery, stood looking at it, and there's a book there which people could sign giving their feelings regarding this. And I noticed he signed it. But, you know, this was a war that was long over before his time. But I could see that he was in tears. Mm-hmm.
Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you might like to talk about at this point?
I think I've held forth about enough. And there are things I could go on and talk about, but...
Would you like to talk about the impact this experience has had on your life?
Yeah. Well, yes. It was a tremendous influence in my life. I can't help but think that my view of history and historical matters have been shaped by this war. My regard for human life, I think, has been directly influenced. I have my feeling for people, I think, has been influenced greatly by the war. We've tried to express that, my wife and I, in various ways, among them with an exchange program with students. And not only those 3 students that we've had for a year at a time, but we've had an awful lot of students come in for lesser periods. Japanese, Chinese, African, all over the world. And we used to have in the community I was in big international weekends, and we'd have about 30 or 40 people, most of them from U of I, and they would come in, spend a night or 2 nights, would have a symposium and discuss problems. It was kind of in that community, it was kind of an exciting time. And but I think the war has helped me shape my political views, my social outlook. I hope for the better. I've had a lot of fun teaching, and a lot of good kids. I think I told you about the boy who asked the question. We were studying, this is early in my teaching career, and it was about 4 years after the war. And this boy was not bright, but he was a bright star in that classroom. He just had a wonderful personality. And but he was probably the poorest student in the bunch, and this was before we, but we had special programs for kids who were slow. We were studying history at the last period of the day. Not a good time to study history, but at that time, if you knew me, I had a 5 o'clock shadow by 3:30 in the afternoon, and we were reading the history book. And it said soldiers have hard times during the war, something like that. Some student raised the question, what do they mean by hard times? Well, I don't like to be graphic with them, so I just told them that there was a time when I went about 6 weeks without having enough water to wash my face. And I said, when I got back, I just had a terrible time scrubbing that soot and the dirt off of my face. And I could see Bruce. He was in the back of the room, and he was really puzzled. And he raised his hand, and he says, I ignored him first, and then he raised his hand again. He says, "Mr. Woolard." And I ignored him this time again, and then he finally says, "Mr. Woolard," and he stood up, and I said, "Bruce, what is it?" He said, "It's still a little bit dark right around here." And the class roared. He was a very popular kid, very handsome, well-built. He just didn't have the enough up here to help him along. And I've had a lot of good kids, a lot of very successful kids. I think that's about all I have to say.
Mr. Woolard, thank you.
It's been a pleasure. This gentleman over here has had to bear all this, and I appreciate the opportunity to. It's had some ups and downs emotionally for me.
I can imagine.
I hope they don't show too much. I moved here. Called History in a Trunk. And we have about 10 trunks. And this is after I left the school business, but I was working with Historical Society. And we developed 10 trunks, each trunk a certain topic. One of them was World War II. One of them. And in there were artifacts of all different kinds. Mm-hmm. Some that showed the contrast of what we first had in a certain period of history and what we have now, like a coal oil lamp. And over here is a bright electric bulb. Mm-hmm. And all the things that go between the development of those. And you use those kinds of things in third, fourth, fifth grade in your teaching. One of them is, and this one takes a little while for the kids to soak in just what it is. The teacher puts out, let's see, how is it? A roll of toilet paper. And one end of the trunk, and the other end, a leaf. And the kids wonder about it, and finally it dawns on them, what is there? And it's an interesting project, and it's going along very well.
Is it going to be continuous?
Yes, it's in its second year now, and we have a group of volunteers. Now I say we because I'm no longer there, but some retired teachers who are quite capable. Mm-hmm. And they are working up these trunks. They go in and talk to the class. They leave the trunk there for a week, and the trunk is picked up and taken to another school. They keep rotating around. It's one of the things that I was able to get started. And although I had done something like this when I headed a fine arts program, improvement of fine arts teaching. It was a 3-year program. I worked at that for 3 years. And then 10 regional or 10 county superintendents asked that I head a project to determine the way that county school offices should be managed in the future. The legislation had been passed that the 102 county superintendents could no longer be that arrangement. We had to reduce the number of counties, county superintendents, by around half. And that meant the merger of county school offices. And how was it to be done? How was it to be financed? What services could it offer for school districts?